Greetings and welcome to the Science Podcast for May 18th, 2007. I'm Stuart Wills, the online editor of Science Magazine. Today, how well can the oceans moderate the atmospheric CO2 increases that are driving global warming? Also in the show, the singing of clownfish, the mysterious collapse of honeybee colonies, and the childhood origins of adult resistance to some scientific ideas. All this plus our usual roundup of other stories from science and its online daily news site, Science Now. So stick around. About one quarter of the carbon dioxide pumped into the atmosphere by human activities is reabsorbed into the oceans. But a new study published online this week by Science suggests that one key ocean may be getting less efficient at performing that crucial balancing act. On the line to tell us more is the lead author of the study, Corinne Lecaire. Dr. Lecaire, welcome to the Science Podcast.
Thank you.
Dr. Lecaire, before we get into the specifics of your study, maybe you could just tell us a little bit about the role of the oceans generally in the carbon cycle.
Of all the human emissions of CO2 that go to the atmosphere, only half stay in the atmosphere and half go into what we call carbon sinks. And the ocean is one of the two carbon sinks. The other one is on land. And so the ocean is really important. It absorbs then a quarter of the emissions of CO2 every year. And if we didn't have carbon sinks at all, then global warming would be happening much faster or twice as fast as it is happening now.
And you looked in particular at one ocean, at the Southern Ocean, the ocean area that basically surrounds Antarctica. Why study that particular ocean?
Because the Southern Ocean is very, very cold, and also it's very windy, and because of the wind, and all the water in the Southern Ocean is mixed much more than in other oceans. So the surface of the ocean is in contact to the atmosphere and to the deep ocean much faster. And so what happens as CO2 goes into the atmosphere, then the Southern Ocean is theoretically capable of absorbing a lot of CO2 emitted to the atmosphere. But on the other hand, it also means that the CO2 that is already stored in the ocean, the natural CO2, has the potential to come back to the atmosphere.
So it was important, I guess, just in general, to get a better handle on what the fluxes of CO2 were in this very active area.
Yes.
Now, how did you and your research team actually get a handle on that problem? It sounds rather tricky.
Yes. What we did is we looked at the CO2 measurements in the atmosphere, so just at the surface of the ocean, and we looked at stations that were around Antarctica, and we compared those with stations that were a little bit further up to the north and to the northern hemisphere. And so by comparing how fast the CO2 is increasing in the different regions, then we were able to say how much the CO2 sinks in the various regions is changing.
And what did you find in that analysis?
We found that the Southern Ocean CO2 sink has not changed since the beginning of the measurements. And this is rather surprising because the emissions themselves, the CO2 emissions to the atmosphere, have increased by 40%. So we would have expected the sinks to just follow the rate of increase of the emissions, and they have not.
I see. It's not so much that it's like absorbing less carbon dioxide somehow. It's just not taking up the increase as in the way that you would expect it. And why would that be the case?
Because the winds have accelerated in the Southern Ocean, they've intensified, and so you have more mixing of the water, and because there's more mixing, then the CO2, the natural CO2 that is stored in the deep ocean is brought up to the surface, and that prevents further absorption of the CO2 emitted to the atmosphere.
You know, when I read your paper, you suggested that this increase in winds was owing to human activity. Could you elaborate on that?
Yeah, there are two things that the human have made, which increase the winds. They're independent from one another. The first one is that ozone depletion changes the temperature and the circulation of the upper atmosphere, and that translates into increased wind in the surface. And the second one is that global warming changes the temperature distribution at the surface, and that also leads to increased winds.
So the same sort of activities that are causing climate change, in this case at least, are hindering the ocean's ability to kind of keep up with the carbon dioxide.
Yes, that's right.
Now, if I understand things correctly, Dr. LeCaire, the models for future global climate change are based partly on sort of, you know, conventional assumptions for how much CO2 the oceans can absorb. Can you tell us what this new finding means for the threat, you know, might mean for the threat of future warming?
Yes. So most models have not included any feedbacks from the carbon cycle. And the models that have included feedback, then they all estimate more warming for the coming century. And they say between 5% and 30% more warming than we currently estimate without CO2 feedbacks. I cannot say exactly what the Southern Ocean role will be. I can only say that this process in particular that we've identified is only partly included in the models. So we know that the models could be more sensitive than they already are, but they're very difficult to evaluate at the moment because we have so little observations.
Well, Dr. LeCaire, thanks for being with us today. Very interesting story.
Thank you.
Corinne LeCaire of the Max Planck Institute for Biogeochemistry, as well as the University of East Anglia and the British Antarctic Survey, is the lead author, with 11 colleagues, of a new study on changes in the Southern Ocean's CO2 uptake. The study was published online this week by Science. On a somewhat lighter note, we now turn to the lowly clownfish, a marine species known to kids worldwide from the hit film Finding Nemo. A new paper in Science's Brevia section this week answers a long-standing question among biologists familiar with this species: how the clownfish makes its song. Science International Managing Editor Andrew Sugden is on the line with us from Cambridge in the UK. Andrew, thanks for being on the show.
Thank you, Stuart.
Well, let me start, Andrew, by confessing my ignorance. I didn't even know that clownfish sing at all.
Well, clownfishes typically live among the tentacles of sea anemones on coral reefs, and they make sounds in the context of their territorial and mating behaviors. I guess it's a bit of a stretch to call it a song in the sense of a melodious sequence of notes. The sounds are more a variety of abrupt clicks and chirps, but certainly good for a fish.
And I guess it's been hard to figure out how these sounds are actually made?
Yes, and although the sounds have been known for decades, and although it's clear that they come from the clownfish's mouth in some sense, the actual mechanism has remained obscure because the moment of the sound production is so rapid and brief. But now we have a team of scientists from Belgium and the United States who've managed to crack it.
And how did they do that?
Well, in short, through technological advances in high-speed video imaging, which they coupled with sound recording and X-ray images, which then replayed in slow motion, these show the movements of the jaw bones and the muscles as the sounds are produced.
And so how do clownfish actually make these sounds?
Well, what these scientists revealed was a coordinated set of movements involving, amongst other things, the raising of the head, the lowering of the jaw, as well as a drawing back of what you might call the chest bones. And all of that ends with a sudden spring-like snapping shut of the jaws. And it's all enabled by a peculiar jaw ligament, which the authors compare to a drawbridge, although the actual sound is made by the collision of the fish's teeth.
So it sounds like a rather complicated set of motions.
It certainly is.
Does this finding have any broader significance beyond this one species?
Well, I think it does, yes, because there are at least 25 different species of clownfish, and each with a unique sound, and hence this sound may have some relevance to species recognition in this group, but also similar sounds are produced in other fishes in the same family of fishes, which is the damsel fishes. So I think this work has wider relevance in an evolutionary sense, as it provides another system for studying the interaction of things like anatomy, biomechanics, and behavior in determining species differences.
Well, Andrew, nice chatting with you.
Very nice chatting with you, Stuart.
Andrew Sugden is the Science International Managing Editor. He spoke with us about a new paper by Eric Parmentier and five colleagues on the sound production mechanisms of the common clownfish. The paper was published in the Brevia section of the May 18th Science. Coming up in a moment, the collapse in honeybee colonies.
Did you know that AAAS members help plug the power of science into public policy? Since 1973, we've brought nearly 2,000 scientists and engineers to Washington, D.C. as science and technology policy fellows. They provide scientific analysis to policymakers in congressional offices and in federal agencies. Find out more at fellowships.AAAS.org. AAAS, advancing science careers, enhancing public policy.
This week in Science's News Focus section, Eric Stockstead reports on an alarming and puzzling phenomenon, a sudden collapse of American and European honeybee colonies that threatens to seriously disrupt common agricultural practices. Eric's in the studio with us now to talk about the story. Eric, thanks for being here.
Glad to drop in.
So, Eric, what's going on here?
We've got a puzzle, Stuart. All across the country, there are reports of sudden and mysterious losses of beehives. The bees are simply gone. Beekeepers don't know what's going on. Scientists are struggling to understand it. Seems to be happening across the country and maybe even in elsewhere around the world as well.
Well, if I'm understanding correctly, though, we've seen these kinds of declines in honeybee populations before. Is there anything that makes this one different?
Well, that's true. And I was a little surprised to learn that 30% of hives is considered standard loss, 20 to 30% of hives among commercial beekeepers. So beekeepers, bee death is nothing new to them. What's different here is really the severity. Beekeepers are reporting sometimes almost all of their hives have collapsed, and that's pretty serious. We don't really have a scientific handle on the severity and the extent of the problem, what's being called colony collapse disorder. There was a self-reported survey of beekeepers, and it found among hundreds and hundreds of beekeepers across the U.S., 29% reported that they had had severe losses that were due to colony collapse disorder. The symptoms, too, are pretty puzzling. Bees will sometimes abandon their hives, but in this case, they'll abandon them, but the queen is still there. It's like the worker bees flew off, never came back, abandoned the queen and all of her brood. And then what's really puzzling is that other insects won't parasitize the hive. This hive is a gold mine of honey, but other insects for a couple of weeks won't come close to it, like there's something really wrong with them.
Well, you say, as you mentioned, this is a puzzle, but are there any thoughts about why it might be happening?
I went to a meeting of top bee scientists recently, and it was pretty easy for them to come up with a list of possible things that were going on, but it's a real struggle to nail down what it is. So you think the list here is perhaps something to do with pesticides, perhaps common bee pathogens, but why now? What's really happening differently? That's a real head-scratcher.
And if I'm reading the story correctly, though, there's also a possibility that some specific beekeeping practices and economics of modern beekeeping might be to blame.
That gets a little more speculative. Beekeepers in the U.S., at least, have really shifted from making money by getting honey to renting the hives for pollination services for farmers, and that involves a lot of road miles. People have the sense that what's going on now really can't be good for bees, and we're talking about putting hundreds of hives on tractor trailers, shipping them all the way across the country, putting them in holding yards, if you imagine sort of a feedlot for bees, giving them lots of sugar syrup so they're really active at a time of year when they're not normally supposed to be active. Some researchers say it can't be good for bees, but we don't really have sort of plausible biological mechanism right now why it might be bad.
Well, that's interesting. So you mentioned that bees are now being used not just for honey services, but sort of for general agricultural pollination services, and that kind of gets to the question of how big a threat this loss of bee colonies really is. Do you have any thoughts on that?
It's a great question. It's an important question. it's hard to say. Think about, you know, our major crops. If you wonder about food security, corn, wind pollinated, soybean, wheat, those are self-pollinated. Bees aren't playing a role there. But there are dozens and dozens of crops, think tomatoes, peppers, all sorts of fresh fruits and vegetables, where honeybees really are the way these get pollinated. Some people have estimated that perhaps it's that value of those services is as much as $14.5 billion. So we do already import a lot of fresh fruits and vegetables, but you know, one thing really is clear, that beekeepers in the U.S. are taking it on the chin. One beekeeper that I talked to, who's been in the business for more than 40 years, said that if he has another year like this, it's going to put him out of business.
Eric, thanks for talking with us today.
Good to be here.
Eric Stockstedt is a news writer with Science and is also the managing editor of the online daily news site Science Now. Just around the corner, how childhood biases can shape adult acceptance of science. Stay with us.
Did you know that the journal Science was founded by Thomas Edison in 1880? Even Edison's inventive mind could not have imagined its evolution into the world's leading journal of groundbreaking research and scientific news, in print and online. AAAS members can access seminars, podcasts, and all issues since 1880. Read today's stories and preview tomorrow's research, all at www.sciencemag.org. AAAS, advancing science into the future.
Certain core scientific ideas, evolution by natural selection being perhaps the most obvious example, seem to have a particularly tough time gaining acceptance in some segments of the public at large. We tend to ascribe resistance to scientific ideas, such as evolution, to religious, cultural, and political factors. But as Paul Bloom and Dina Skolnick-Weisberg of Yale University point out in a review in this week's Science, there are psychological factors at work here as well, and those factors have their roots in assumptions and biases that trace to childhood. We're very pleased to have Dr. Bloom on the line with us to explore this further. Dr. Bloom, welcome.
Thanks very much for having me here.
Well, Dr. Bloom, you say in your review that some of the resistance to scientific ideas stems from two general facts about children, what they know and how they learn. Let's start with what they know.
Well, one of the big findings in developmental psychology is just how much knowledge we start off with. So there's some very dramatic studies suggesting that even babies have some understanding of the physical world. They know objects are solid, that they persist over time, and that they are subject to gravity. They fall to the ground if unsupported. They also have some understanding of people, of the psychological world. So they know that people move autonomously, that we act and react based on our goals. We have beliefs, desires, and emotions. And these types of understanding, what psychologists call naive physics and naive psychology, provides a rich foundation for future learning.
But unfortunately, I guess the problem is what happens when something a bit more complicated comes along to challenge those kind of naive frameworks.
Exactly. I mean, a lot of the insights of science clash with common sense, and this is difficult to deal with. And there's all sorts of examples, one of which you mentioned in the introduction is evolution. So common sense means that we see the world in terms of agency and design. If you see something that's complicated, like a tree or a tiger, you assume someone intended it to be that way. And this makes a non-psychological process like natural selection very hard to grasp. A second example is neuroscience. So common sense tells us that we're separate from our bodies. We're common sense dualists. And because of this, the materialist scientific view of the mind just doesn't sit right with us.
Okay, so children will look at the world in kind of a commonsensical way and won't essentially be equipped for information that kind of goes against common sense. But why would these issues persist into adulthood? I mean, we have something called education. Shouldn't that be able to overcome that? Or?
Well, there are different factors here, but one consideration is that going beyond common sense often requires some degree of trust. So nobody has the time or ability to evaluate all the scientific arguments on their merits. To some extent, you have to defer to the authorities. You take most people who claim to believe in evolution by natural selection, for instance, and you ask them what they mean by evolution. It turns out the majority don't fully understand what they're talking about there. They believe in it because they trust the scientists. They trust them enough to put aside their common sense beliefs. I believe in E equals MC squared, but I can't explain why. I just believe it because I know smart people assert that it's true. In general, education then is going to fail when either of two things happen. It's going to fail if you don't trust the scientists, and it's going to fail if there's some other authority, such as religious authorities, that you trust more.
Well, that's very interesting, because you did mention in your article that there are these cultural differences in the acceptance of science. For example, that Americans tend to be more resistant to evolutionary theory than those in most other countries, or many other countries at least. Does that mean scientists just aren't trusted as much in the U.S. as they are in many other societies?
I think the dynamic here is somewhat different. In the United States, there are vocal religious and political authorities that challenge certain scientific views, particularly with regard to evolution. And many people trust these authorities more than they trust the scientists. Also, because there's this conflict, the issue is often framed in terms of a debate between different constituencies. So some people see it that intelligent design is favored by the religious, the conservatives, and the Republicans, while evolution is more of a secular, liberal, Democrat sort of thing. If you look at it this way, you're going to choose your view on this matter based on the politics. I don't think the same sort of situation exists in much of Western Europe, so I can't really speak for anywhere else.
So there's this whole kind of tie-up and complex situation where issues of trust are wrapped into issues of personal politics as well.
I think that's exactly right. I think that because deference is involved, you do need to have some level of trust. And to the extent that there are political and cultural forces opposing that trust, you become less faith in science.
Well, you note in your article, Dr. Bloom, finally, that resistance to science is actually an important societal issue, and I think many of the listeners, at least to this program, would agree. Does the evidence from developmental psychology that you're reviewing here in this article have anything to tell us about how we should be approaching that societal issue?
I think there are two policy ideas that come from this approach. The first is I think, fairly obvious and has to do with science education. So if you want to teach science, it really helps to know what biases children start off with. You have to know what to overcome. And as some psychologists have put it, the big obstacle in science education isn't that children are ignorant. It's rather that they start off knowing the wrong things. I think more tentatively, there's a case to be made, given the importance of deference, that scientists should work harder to persuade people that what they have to say about the world actually does carry a lot of weight. You want to have a situation in which, even if you don't know anything about the facts, when it comes to, say, the age of the Earth, you should take a geologist more seriously than a priest, because you should understand that the geologist has uniquely powerful tools through which to learn about these things. And along these lines, I think a further implication is that scientific organizations should be extremely reticent about taking political or moral stands about the war in Iraq or capital punishment or whatever, because the cost of taking these stands is that people treat you, again, as just another constituency. If they could reason, if I don't agree with your politics, why should I defer to you about all of this other stuff? So given the importance of deference, I think we need to do a better job of earning people's trust.
So stay out of politics and stick to the science.
That sums it up.
Well, Dr. Bloom, thanks very much for talking with us today.
Thank you.
Paul Bloom is the co-author with Dina Skolnick-Weisberg of Childhood Origins of Adult Resistance to Science, a review article in the May 18th issue of Science. Finally today, David Grimm, the editor of Science's free daily news site Science Now, is in the studio with Tanisha Riley of AAAS for our usual roundup of other recent stories.
David, it's good to see you again, and what interesting science topics do you have for us today?
Three interesting topics for you, Tanisha, as always. We'll talk about why Alexander the Great was, in fact, not so great, talk about where Australians came from, and finally, why you might weigh a little bit less depending on where you stand in Canada.
All sounds good. Okay. Some historians may be a little upset about this first piece, but could you explain to me about this not-so-great Alexander?
Right. Well, as most of you probably know, Alexander the Great was a very famous military commander around 300 BCE. And on his way to trying to conquer the world, he had already conquered a couple of Phoenician cities and really wanted to capture this island called Tyre. And Tyre was important strategically because if he caught Tyre, then he would be able to control a major port in the eastern Mediterranean. But Tyre was tricky because Tyre, besides being an island, was about 1 kilometer off the coast of what's modern-day Lebanon. And the waters that separated the Tyre from let's just say, Lebanon, were thought to be about 10 meters deep and rough waves and open seas and things like that. Mm-hmm. But somehow, over the course of 7 months, Alexander constructed this bridge that let his army cross into Tyre, conquer the city, and the rest, as they say, is history.
So what's wrong with that?
Well, what's wrong with that is that Alexander's accomplishment may not have been as impressive as historians have recorded. A team of geoscientists have been analyzing the sediment rate of deposit between Tyre and modern-day Lebanon, or Lebanon today, actually. And what they found is that in the 5,000 or so years that preceded Alexander's time, there was actually a lot of sediment activity going on, sediment deposition activity going on between Tyre and the mainland, where actually Mother Nature was actually constructing its own bridge underwater. And by the time Alexander got there and wanted to make his bridge, there was an underwater bridge that was only 1 or 2 meters below sea level. So although Alexander's feat was not that impressive because he didn't have to contend with 10 meters deep of sea, only a couple meters deep of sea, we shouldn't take too much away from him. It was still a very impressive feat and an impressive military victory, just not as impressive as we once thought it was.
Okay, and next let's talk about a bigger island, although it's not really an island, but it's isolated like one.
Right. Right. Well, that island or continent is Australia. And like Tyre, separated from nearby land, but instead of 1 kilometer, it's separated by about 60 kilometers from the biggest next biggest landmass. And that's made Australia very tricky to get to, both today and actually 50,000 years ago, when it's thought that the first humans migrated to Australia. And researchers have been trying to figure out just how this migration happened. Some anthropologists have said over the past 50,000 years, many different migrations have happened to Australia. People have gone there several times, and the population we see today, the Aboriginal population we see today, is a mix of many of those migrations. But other anthropologists have said, no, there was only one migration about 50,000 years ago, and the people that got there 50,000 years ago are the people that are there today are direct descendants of those people, those first people that got there 50,000 years ago. But it's been really tricky to figure out exactly what happened.
So what happened?
I'm glad you asked. To figure out, to get a better idea of what happened, a team of scientists analyzed Y chromosome DNA and mitochondrial DNA of several of the Aboriginal Australians that are currently inhabit Australia today. And what they can do was they can actually construct, knowing how frequently mutations happen in this kind of DNA, they can actually construct sort of a molecular clock. And not only does the DNA tell them about these people and sort of what their genetic history is, but it actually tells them how far back this genetic history goes. And what the researchers found was that the Aborigines that are on Australia today have actually been there for 50,000 years. And what's really interesting, what they found based on this genetic data, was that this original population that got there about 50,000 years ago remained isolated for tens of thousands of years until new people started coming. But for the most part, what you see in Australia today are really descendants of this original migration that happened 50,000 years ago. And it just shows how difficult it was to get to Australia so long ago. It was so difficult that really people only made it there once. Once they got there, nobody really came again for tens of thousands of years. So a really interesting study and tells us a little bit more about early human migration and how it led to the peoples that we see around the world today.
That sounds interesting. I can't imagine how hard it would have been to get there by boat as it is.
Right,
you know,
right.
Now
it's hard enough to get there by plane.
Yeah, exactly. And finally, a story about feeling slim in Canada.
Right. So this is a very interesting story. And I'd never heard about this before, but apparently there are a couple regions in northern Canada that flank the Hudson Bay where you actually weigh a little bit less than you do anywhere else in the world, not a whole lot less, about 1/4,000th of a percent less. But still, if you're watching your weight, every little bit counts. And so scientists have been trying to figure out exactly why this is, and actually if it's true. Mm-hmm. And so what they did was a team of scientists use NASA's twin GRACE satellites. And these satellites track gravitational anomalies in the Earth. And they focused them on this region of Canada, and they found, indeed, that the gravity at this part of Canada and these two regions of Canada were about 1/25,000th less than it is elsewhere on the planet.
So why would that be, David?
Well, what happened, researchers think, is about 20,000 years ago, North America lay under what was called the Laurentide Ice Sheet, which was this massive glacier about 3 kilometers thick in some locations. And at two locations, actually, it was so thick that it formed these huge domes, which really compressed the Earth's mantle and caused these actually dimples to form on the Earth's surface. And these dimples are where the gravity is a little bit less. And so not only does this give us this interesting find about you can actually have places on the Earth where gravity is a little bit less than other places, but it also tells geologists a little bit about how glaciers move and how they can affect the dynamics of the planet, which wasn't known. And they say in about 300,000 years, these dimples will actually start to fill in. And by that time, that gravity difference will be not a difference anymore. Those regions will be the same as the rest of the planet. So if you're looking to watch your weight in 300,000 years, you're going to have to look elsewhere.
It's space now.
It's space, exactly.
Well, thank you, David. Interesting as usual.
Thanks, Tanisha.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the free online daily news service of Science. You can catch up with these and other stories on the site at sciencenow.sciencemag.org.
And that wraps up the May 18th, 2007 Science Podcast. The show is a production of Science Magazine and of AAAS, the Science Society, with additional financial support from the Golden Fund. The content is provided by the news and editorial staff of Science, and Jeffrey Cook composed the music for the show. I'm Stuart Wills, the online editor of Science. On behalf of the journal and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, thanks for joining us.